From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents the fourth part of a discussion of authorship in the United States, with attention to topics including creative writing programs, the continuation of America's literary inheritance, and the ways in which apprentice writers, publishers, editors, and reviewers assume professional status. The speakers are James West, Edmund Fuller, Matthew Hodgson, and Lee Smith. James West is a professor of English at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book on authorship in America. Edmund Fuller is chief book critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's written novels, nonfiction, and textbooks. Matthew Hodgson is director of the University of North Carolina Press. Lee Smith teaches creative writing at North Carolina State University. Her most recent books are Black Mountain Breakdown, a novel, and Cakewalk, a collection of short stories. The conversation begins now with comments from James West about courses and institutes for aspiring publishers.
Publishing institutes, if nothing else, will disabuse that starry-eyed young person of the notion that he or she will immediately go to New York and begin working with the manuscripts of young novelists. A great part of the work in publishing, in fact, I suppose the majority of the work is in advertising and distribution and record keeping and all of those things. And in fact, a great portion of the work of any editor is in a general house, a trade house, is not necessarily on fiction. He may have to deal with calendars or cookbooks or how to do it books or the memoirs of a famous general or movie star. And so I think that kind of training can be very good. Again, publishing doesn't have an apprenticeship program, a farm system, as it were. There are no hurdles that one necessarily has to clear to get into publishing in the same way that doctors, lawyers, or other so-called professionals do. Oftentimes the ticket into publishing is inherited wealth or family connection, and a great many times the avenues by which one gets into publishing, so far as I can observe, are not because you're particularly trained for it, but you get into publishing and then you learn the business.
But isn't that essentially true of almost all businesses? For instance, that the ticket is some inherited wealth or a connection, a linkage of some sort? I would doubt that that was unique to any great degree for publishing. And I wonder if Matt might not have something to say about that, in that in entering the publishing field, one of the traditional ways, even for a scion of the family, was to come in through the sales department. Yeah. That Matt mentioned a little earlier.
Well, that was the apprenticeship, and everyone did it. Mm-hmm. That has been dropped, in a sense, or has been watered down. In other words, if a person's on the road a year, he may be invited in, or she may be invited in. So I think there isn't the kind of traditional apprenticeship that once existed, possibly because it was too rigorous, that young people today would not submit to it.
Yes.
Not for 7 years, and then, you know, in the hope that they may be invited to do something more important.
I'd like to say something really cynical at this point about the idea of an apprenticeship for young would-be publishers or people in publishing, which is the same thing. I think the something like the Radcliffe Publishing School serves the same function as an MFA program, say, for a young fiction writer. And frankly, you meet people who can help you. You know, I mean, the young fiction writer has the writers in residence who are coming through, giving workshops, and if they like you or they like your work, they can recommend you to an editor. And a lot of it really does have to do, unfortunately, very unfortunately, with who do you know, with your contacts. And the Radcliffe Publishing School, again, you're liable to meet somebody who can give you a job.
This is the world.
Well, I expressed general approbation for publishing procedures courses. For people who aspire, you know, to know more about publishing, may go into it. No, I'm not at all against those. We were talking about the apprenticeship. Now, what you have now, I think there have been cases right along and of people of means, young persons, who, in a sense, buy their way into a company.
Bennett Cerf did.
Well, many others have. Horace Liveright, for years, sole vice presidencies, every time his capital went a little low. And it was a way for a person who has money, but let's say no particular connections in New York City, no, who wants to be very much in the middle of its cultural and literary life. That's one way, buy your way in.
And it's fair.
You
either, like Bennett Cerf, who turned into a first-rate publisher, and there's some other more dilettantish types who bought their way in and then dropped out.
I didn't mean to suggest that there was anything wrong with doing that. And as a matter of fact, I was going to say that the apprenticeship program that publishing has developed over the years, sort of by hit and miss, may be a good deal more effective and may turn out better publishers than the apprenticeship program that turns out lawyers or doctors in our country, or engineers or other sorts of professionals.
I would also return to the subject a minute. There were at least two publishing firms during my youth when all of the editors that I knew, all of the executives, had private incomes.
Well, on the matter of apprenticeships, one very large change has occurred, very much for the better. I can well remember many years in publishing when the cynical answer to a young woman who might be a college graduate from a first-rate college would say, "I want to get into publishing. How do you do?" Learn to type and take shorthand, and come in as a secretary, and if you're lucky, after a period of time, you'll win somebody's confidence and they'll begin to entrust you with some other kinds of functions. That held true for years and years and years. Apparently that has come to an end some time back now. One of the things that I think is most interesting, and while I think socially it is unquestionably a good thing, in terms of some of the other elements of publishing, the commercial versus the non-commercial, it is as different as it is with men, but women are a major factor in American book publishing now, from the executive business level to the editorial management level. They hold high and key positions indeed. And as I say, there's all that I know some women in publishing who are just as narrowly commercially oriented as any of the men are, and
more
some
so.
maybe even so, yeah.
Lee, I wanted to ask you a question. You are employed in a university, and a great many creative writers these days do draw their steady income from universities as writers in residence. There is practically no college, however small, that doesn't offer at least one or two courses in creative writing. What effect do you think this has on the author who must function in an academic environment?
I think it has a terrible effect. I think it has a deadening effect, but I don't know any way to get around it, because what you have to do if you're a writer is find a way, I mean, unless you're one of the very, you know, very few who can support themselves with their writing, what you have to do is find a way to make a living that also allows you time to write. And there are very few jobs that you can have that'll give you the summer off, that'll give you 2 weeks off, that will allow you to talk about what you love, which is writing, and deal with it. But ultimately, it's very hard to deal with student manuscripts over years and years and years without kind of losing your judgment. You sort of forget what is good. You know, it makes it very hard for you to judge your own work or to keep on doing it. And if you're somebody, well, like me, who tends to write about, say, small town life and sort of the more traditionally Southern things, I'm not in day-to-day contact with what activates my own imagination, with what makes me think of a story at all in my work. And so over the years, this could be very bad. I mean, I have to go back to the mountains frequently, and I have to subscribe to lots of small town newspapers in order to keep in mind what it is that I need to write about.
Charge your batteries.
Charge my batteries. And I think the effect is very is very bad, although on the other hand, it does give you time and it does give you the opportunity to deal with what you love. Yeah. I don't know. I think every writer, first of all, has to deal with a whole lot of sort of autobiographical schlock. You know, everybody's got a first novel in them, right? It's always the story of an initiation story, and you have to write that. And then you kind of flounder around and write a not-so-hot second novel, I think. And then at some point, you reach this interesting point where I've gotten where you've used up your entire life, which is which is both threatening and very liberating.
Now the universe is before you.
Right, yeah. You know, it's all right out of my head, and that's very exciting in a sense.
I would like to make an observation, if I could. Sooner or later, there seems to be a want of personal culture that a university education can give one. A study of classics, languages, history, right?
Yeah.
So
forth. Mm.
There you fall back on it for your subsequent novels. It reminded me of, the James Jones, From Here to Eternity. And someone, I think an editor of Knopf, was asked to write an essay about this, about Jones. It's a phenomenon. The book had sold wildly, and I was a good, effective novel. But he said he doubted very seriously whether Mr. Jones could write other very good novels, and implied a want of personal culture.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's go back to the famous audience or encounter of Samuel Johnson and King George III. And the king asked Johnson what he was going to write, or what he's writing now. I've written all. I must go back and read some more.
Yes.
That.
Yes.
In other words, I think that we're turning out a lot of people with some technical skills at writing,
mm-hmm,
and some talent. But I think what they're lacking is a personal culture.
Mm-hmm.
They
I would agree.
Don't read enough.
Right.
Or haven't read anything that goes back as far as the 19th
right,
century.
Right. They've left mm-hmm. they've left the nest yeah. too early.
Mm-hmm.
But even let's say people without formal college degrees, university degrees. Ernest Hemingway was a very well-read man.
Mm-hmm.
His books, suggest this, show it. So was Faulkner.
Mm-hmm.
They read all the time. They had,
right.
Deep personal culture.
Oh, I didn't mean to suggest that the creative writing course is in any sense a substitute for being, educated, well-read, and literate.
This
at
is
all.
What I, though I think some students believe, that it's sort of a shortcut,
mm-hmm,
in a way.
Oh, yes.
And you do learn technical skills, no question about it. There is value. And it has nothing to do with those of you who teach creative writing. It has a lot to do with whoever determines what a university curriculum should be.
That's right. I am reminded of something that was probably the worst thing that was ever said to me, and the truest, when I was about 18 years old and had been through several of these writing courses and, wrote pretty well. And one of my teachers was reading a story that I'd written. This is Julia Randall, who's a poet. And she said, Lee, you write really well, but there's one problem. And I said, well, what is it? And she said, you don't have anything to say.
Mm-hmm.
Which was just damning. And it was also really quite true. Because being that young and not having read a lot, not having a kind of a background, that what you have to say is what happened last weekend. So what?
You can't, in other words, the average writer can't live all of the things he writes about. Hemingway, I think, probably tried. So you borrow upon what you've read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you how many. Couldn't tell you how many young, aspiring writers have come into my office and said, "Yeah, man, I want to be a writer." And if you ask them, you say, "What have you read lately?" And they say, "No, man, don't like to read. Want to write." And they don't see the connection, and it's hard to make it for them. I was going to say that one of the things a university writing teacher, a writer in residence, must guard against, it would seem to me, though, would be a very strong ego. You really are put in a position in a university as a teacher of creative writing, a position where you can be adored and fawned upon. And I've known a number of situations in which a writer with a strong ego creates his own little group of satellite apprentice writers around him or her, all of whom imitate the master's style and the master's way of dressing and so forth. And of course, that may be a stage in anyone's development we have to imitate before we can be ourselves. But and maybe the writer in residence is valuable in giving something for the young writer eventually to rebel against.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to go through your apprenticeship of copying and then find yourself and go out on your own.
John Farrar's favorite phrase for that was finding your own voice at last, which takes a while.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to part four of the Center's recent conference on authorship in America. The speakers are James West, Lee Smith, Edmund Fuller, and Matthew Hodson. James West teaches English at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. He's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book about authorship in the United States. Lee Smith's most recent books are Black Mountain Breakdown, a novel, and Cakewalk, a collection of short stories. She teaches creative writing at North Carolina State University. Edmund Fuller is chief book critic for the Wall Street Journal. And Matthew Hodson is director of the University of North Carolina Press.
Lee, recently there was a Writers' Congress in New York City organized by the magazine Nation. And one of the overt purposes, one of the stated purposes of that meeting was to explore possibilities for unionization among writers. Do you think that's possible? Or let me ask you this. Do you belong to any writers' organizations?
Mm-hmm. I belong to one of the organizations which was responsible, in fact, for that meeting, which is PEN, P-E-N. Mm-hmm. And I believe very strongly that in the idea of unionization, I think it's would be, however, almost impossible to effect for the very same reason that I didn't attend the meeting, which is that quite simply, most of us have to have another profession, as we have said several times, and we have to belong to SAMHSA or whatever. I mean, their other profession involves a type of union, a type of professional membership, too, and I don't know that that it's possible to lump them all together, and they had so much trouble too with people wishing to use it as a political forum and this kind of thing. I don't know that it's possible. I don't know that the profession exists as a profession to the extent that it would be possible to organize it, such as the screenwriters do. I doubt very much that that's going to ever come about.
The writers who have organized most successfully have been those who worked in shop situations. Screenwriters have done so quite well.
Yes.
And newspaper writers have organized pretty well together. There have been a great many attempts by writers to organize themselves, beginning again back in about the 1880s and 1890s. And of course, there was that flurry in the 1930s with the four writers' congresses, which at least got a lot of headlines for a while. But it may be that temperamentally, authors are incapable of organizing, among other things. How would you strike?
It's a group of solitaries.
Well,
that's right.
Yes, the Authors League and the Dramatists Guild, as part of it, have done some work about trying to formulate contractual terms and so forth that would be helpful, and I'm sure they have done, but I can't resist the story about the late Rex Stout, who was for many years the head of the Authors League and was a diligent recruiter, and any time anybody published a book, Rex Stout would bombard them with letters saying,
yep,
you should join, and I always resisted joining because I just happened to be a loner by nature, and I would only affiliate in the face of something like a Sovietization. In other words, a fight for genuine liberty would stir me. But he wrote one of those letters, and I'm sure other people received them. He wrote to me and he said, you should be grateful that you live in a country where it is possible for writers to form themselves into an organization. And so that one I replied to, and I wrote back and said, "Dear Mr. Stout, I am also grateful to live in a country where I am not compelled to join an organization."
So. Well, what would be the objective of such a union? As Edmund says, who do you strike?
Well, that's one. That's one of the great difficulties. Exactly what would writers organize for? Who would their adversary be? It's utterly illogical to think of the publisher as one's adversary. Ideally, the publisher is your partner. Your aims and the publisher's should be the same. But, of course, a good many writers do see publishers as adversaries. Maybe the commercial climate of the times encourages that. But perhaps some help or advice in dealing with publishers would be a possibility. But again, here again, the agent often fulfills that function these days and educates the author. Ideally, he educates the author about what the author's rights are and what things to demand in the contract and so on and so forth.
The relationship, the first relationship between an author and a publisher is an adversarial one. It's a business. The publisher is attempting to get this manuscript for as little as he has to pay for it. The author, on the other hand, is trying to get as much as he or she can in the way of advances against royalties, guaranteed royalties, and so forth. But that can't be denied. And I think that any union of authors probably would take up this matter of remuneration. Mm-hmm. There is a feeling, and I think it was justified in the past, that publishers did not pay authors sufficient royalties.
Mm-hmm. And smaller things would come up, like how many times can they require you to rewrite and revise and
that,
so on?
That, and I don't know
this
that's
kind of
negotiable.
Thing. And if they have, well, I know, but I mean, this kind of thing would come up, or if they have an option on your book and you do it according to specification and then they turn it down, you know, there are things that could theoretically be worked out or legislated for, against, and so on. I mean, there are points of copyright.
I think the copyright laws certainly would, you know, interest both authors and publishers. And
duplication, possible different kinds of duplication. I mean, there are things that really could be clarified, I think.
Lee, let me ask you, from your standpoint as a writer, do you feel that there is a literary heritage that you have a stake in?
Well, certainly I feel like there's a literary heritage that I have a stake in that I want to respond to and uphold and this kind of thing. But I feel that, again, a writer is not only somebody who writes, but somebody who is read and so on. And it troubles me very much, the idea actually that there are certain kinds of things that I would wish to write that I think maybe would fall in line with some of this literary tradition that we're talking about that would never be published if I chose to write them. I mean, I do have to take in terms of from among different kinds of books and different novels that I might have in my head which ones to write. I think I too am influenced. I think all writers are influenced by the fact that we're working with a largely non-literate population. I mean, and there's certain things that I know that there's almost no point in writing except for myself.
Edmund, do you get a sense from the correspondence, I assume you receive from your readers,
Yes.
Do you get a sense that people are aware of a literary heritage? How do they think about it?
I think they do show an awareness. I don't know how to judge the readers of the Wall Street Journal are an immensely diversified and probably on the whole a very highly educated readership.
So it isn't necessarily representative.
It is not necessarily representative. On the other hand, it is quite a large group. Mm-hmm. And the volume of mail I get, most of it from people who obviously are enthusiastic readers and respond, never do I get quite so much mail sometimes as when I have gone back and mentioned some classic book. These don't happen to be American, but I've occasionally done columns on Jane Austen or Trollope or so on and so forth, and gotten deluged with mail from people who say, oh, I'm so glad that you wrote about Trollope or so on and so forth. So there are plenty of literate people out there. But I think the battle may be being lost with the rising generations. I am seriously concerned about that, as Matt is. And
I think there's one sort of you have these little glimmers of light occasionally, and one happened, I think, rather recently. And this was the now celebrated case of a public school board banning Huckleberry Finn from a reading list, and there was a firestorm of protest. Editorials appearing not simply in major newspapers, but smaller ones throughout the country, which showed that the editorialists understood exactly that Twain's novel was a marvelous, unrelenting attack on bigotry. And perhaps the most admirable figure in the novel is Nigger Jim.
Exactly.
And mm-hmm. And people mm-hmm. recognize that.
Sure.
It's a marvelous novel.
I agree fully with everything you two gentlemen have said about what people should be reading, but I want you to get down in the galleys and row with us and see what 10 years of teaching will do of trying to teach Homer or trying to teach the Aeneid or attempting to teach Jane Austen or Dickens. You simply can't do it. They don't understand it. They cannot read it or comprehend what is in those books. How you change that, I really have no idea.
I would like to cut back for a moment, if I can, to something that was stirred up in my mind by the discussion of the heritage that we are losing by the fact that many major works by many of our major writers lapsed from print and so on. Well, with the immense proliferation of the printed word in our time, the immense and very undiscriminating proliferation of it, you have an irony that I think grows more and more. It has always been the first challenge for the writer to get into print. But an even tougher challenge for the writer nowadays is to stay in print. And one of the sad things, and I know no answer to it, is that a great many splendid books, excellent books, among the best books now published, are, after 2 or 3 years, out of print with very, very little the probability or likelihood of ever being brought back into print again, and they may represent actually the most substantial and meritorious part of the publishing seasons of the years in which they appeared. And since many of these books were printed in rather small editions to begin with, that the diminishing chance of finding them. By the way, I fell prey to what is apparently one of the great popular myths. I labored for a long time until recently under the belief that the Library of Congress, through its copyright function, kept on file copies of every book published in the United States, and I have recently learned that that is not so. And I had always thought, you know, if any book disappears, you can always at least find it at the Library of Congress, but you can't necessarily. But this matter of, it is a harder challenge, it seems to me, in many ways now, for many works of substance to stay in print than to get in print in the first place.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me this week for Soundings, with part 4 in the center's series on the profession of authorship in the United States. My guests are a scholar at the National Humanities Center who's writing a book on the subject, a novelist and teacher of creative writing, the director of the University of North Carolina Press, and the chief book critic for the Wall Street Journal. The topics include creative writing in American universities and the ways in which apprentice writers, publishers, and editors assume professional status. That's The Profession of Authorship in America, Part 4, this week on Soundings.